Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And Leo. And
we're here tonight to bring you a little bit of news and an interview. We have an interview with Andrew Gause, an economist. Uncle Sam Cooks the Books and a couple of other really good books. It's a very timely interview because he comments on the state of the economy. We talk about some things that maybe we could do to help ourselves if our government elected representatives would wake up and listen to people who know something and understand how the system works. You listen to regular radio and you listen to TV, all they talk about is what's wrong and how much money we owe and where these earmarks are going and this and that and criticizing the stimulus package. That really isn't the issue. It's not the issue at all. And you listen to this interview with Andrew Gause and you'll understand a little bit better about what the issue really is. It's more fundamental than that. And you really have to understand the banking system and how it works in order to fix it. These people that are talking on television and radio do not understand the banking system.
And
therefore, they don't know how to fix it.
And not only that, if they do understand it, they're not talking because they don't want it to be fixed. They don't want it to be fixed.
Because they're there at the grace of the people who make money from the banking system.
That's right.
So stay tuned and listen to that interview, and you'll have some food for thought, or some words for thought, anyway. So
and,
in the meantime, we have a few things to read before we get to that interview. From CNNMoney.com, Rumsfeld's growing stake in Tamiflu. He may be out of a job, but he's not out of bucks. The prospect of bird flu outbreak may be panicking people around the globe, but it's proving to be very good news for Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and other politically connected investors in Gilead Sciences, the California biotech company that owns the rights to Tamiflu, the influenza remedy that's now the most sought-after drug in the world. Rumsfeld served as Gilead Research's chairman from 1997 until he joined the Bush administration in 2001. So he went from fighting viruses and germs to killing people.
And he also included the notorious aspartame, which is your artificial sweeteners.
Which also kills people.
Killer.
So I guess he had
causes brain tumors and all kinds of mental diseases.
I guess he was well prepped to go on and drop bombs, huh?
Yeah, and Tamiflu is a worthless piece of work.
Well, let me just read this.
Doesn't do anything for anybody.
Okay, and let me just finish this article. He still holds a Gilead stake valued at between $5 million and $25 million, according to the federal financial disclosures filed by Rumsfeld. The forms don't reveal the exact number of shares Rumsfeld owns, but in the past 6 months, fears of a pandemic and the ensuing scramble for Tamiflu have sent Gilead stocks from $35 to $47. That's made the Pentagon chief already one of the wealthiest members of Bush's cabinet. I'm reading this. And I'm just realizing that this article was printed October 31st, 2005. So it's really not timely. Let me just finish saying this.
Yeah.
The reason I'm saying this is that because the stock's probably not worth that now. So this part of it is not timely and not correct because the stock market has taken a plunge all over the place. So this is old news, Leo. I was just looking at this.
I just noticed that, too.
And I remember reading this article in the past.
Right, there was another one.
Let me just say that excuse me. Leo had handed me this article to read, but I can see that it's not timely and probably isn't true right now, but he's still making money from
That's the one I wanted you to read.
From Tamiflu. But this was this is not his article. This is a different one.
No, this is another one. This is the one that I wanted you to read.
This is the one from March 2009. That was from 2005, and things have changed. So who knows how much he owns, how much Rumsfeld owns. Resistance to flu drug widespread in the U.S. This is the article he wanted from Reuters. Virtually all cases of the most common strain of flu circulating in the United States now resist the main drug used to treat it, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported on Monday. CDC researchers said 98% of all flu samples from the H1N1 strain were resistant to Roche's AG's Tamiflu. That's Rumsfeld.
The one you were talking about, right?
A pill that can both treat flu and prevent infection. Four patients infected with the resistant strain have died, including two children. This year, H1N1 is the most common strain of flu in the United States, although the flu season is a mild one so far and still below the levels considered an epidemic. Few doctors even test patients for flu, and Tamiflu is not widely prescribed, but the news is sobering because the pill, known generically as oseltamivir, is one of the few weapons against influenza, which kills an estimated 36,000 people in the United States in an average year. It is also considered a key weapon against potential pandemic of a new type of influenza, and this study suggests the virus can rapidly invade its effects. This season, nine children have died from influenza, most apparently healthy before they got infected. Last season, only 19% of H1N1 viruses tested were Tamiflu resistant. As of February 19, 2009, resistance to oseltamivir has been identified among 264 of 268 U.S. influenza H1N1 viruses tested. They interviewed 99 patients and found 30% of them had been vaccinated against the flu, but became infected anyway. The vaccine is known not to fully protect against infection. Two patients died on the way to the hospital or in the emergency department. One patient was 4 years old and previously healthy, and one patient was 4 years old with neurological problems. Dr. David Weinstock of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and Dr. Gina Zuccotti of Brigham and Women's Children's Hospital, both in Boston, said the quick spread of Tamiflu-resistant flu has surprised doctors. Undoubtedly, new surprises await in the potential struggle with influenza, as one thing is certain, the organism will continue to evolve. And that's true. We get new strains all the time. For now, the best tools to mitigate influenza infection are tried and true vaccination, social distancing, hand washing, that's an important one, and common sense. GlaxoSmithKline, which makes the rival flu drug Relenza, said there was no indication influenza viruses were resistant to its drug. Relenza, known genetically as Zanamivir, is inhaled and is used even less commonly than Tamiflu. Flu already resists two older drugs, memantine and amantadine. I've never even heard of them. I guess I've never been given any drugs like that. There is no indication that the other two types of season flu now circulating, H3N2 and influenza B, resist the effects of Tamiflu, and the CDC recommends using a cocktail of flu drugs in patients now. Hundreds of thousands of flu patients continue to be treated with Tamiflu this season, Roche said in a statement. Treatment with the antivirals such as Tamiflu can lessen the duration and severity of the illness. It can help curb the spread of flu, especially in a crowded settings like households, schools, and nursing homes. I don't know. I don't think I'd.
I don't think I would take it. It doesn't work for anything. And,
you know, I think it's just a big crock
that
stuff is.
Yeah, it goes back to even back to 2005 in that first article about Tamiflu. No, that one yeah, this one here relates to it. And there have been others that have said that, other doctors that said that it was useless against, unless it was taken right away, right at the outset of the flu.
Not in that article.
Right at the outset of the flu. It was useless. So anyway, and they continue to, you know, advocate it as a with other drugs. For those of you who do know or don't know about the wonders of Hillary Clinton's Middle East visit, she pledged $900 million to Gaza. All right. However,
as humanitarian aid.
Right. However,
it turns out it's not like that.
Yeah. It says, read the fine print. This is from Mangda Wise, philipwise.org. Read the fine print. One-third of the U.S. pledge at Gaza conference goes to Gaza, none of it for rebuilding. One of the headlines comes out of Gaza donors, out of the Gaza donors conference currently being held in Egypt, and the U.S. Pledge of $900 million for the Palestinians. What is less, what is getting less attention is that only one-third of that will actually go to Gaza, and none of that will be used for rebuilding. The breakdown of the pledge is as follows. Excuse me. State Department spokesman Robert A. Wood said that the breakdown of the $900 million was $300 million for urgent humanitarian needs in Gaza, $200 million to help the Palestinian Authority meet its budget, and $400 million for the authority's program to improve governance, security, and economic development. All right. Although Hillary Clinton's message at Sharm el-Sheikh is that the aid to Gaza cannot be separated from the peace process and that aid must foster conditions in which a Palestinian state can be fully realized, the U.S.'s own pledge is undermining that very goal. Instead of helping the people of Gaza, it seems that the U.S.'s first priority is to prop up the Abbas government. In addition to sending two-thirds of their aid to the West Bank based on West Bank-based government, the U.S. is withholding all aid for rebuilding Gaza out of political concerns for Hamas. The LA report, the LA Times reports, U.S. officials are opposed to spending any money on reconstruction aid to Gaza that might fall into the hands of Hamas and help strengthen the group's standing among the enclave 1.5 million residents. By refusing to fund rebuilding and by sidelining Hamas rather than engaging them, the U.S. is supporting the devastation or the devastating and illegal Israeli siege on Gaza and maintaining the conditions that led to conflict in the past. The aid the U.S. is offering is not enough to keep Gazans alive, but not enough to actually change the situation. It looks like the Ariel Sharon policy towards Gaza, as articulated by advisor Dov Weisglass, is still in effect. And that is, it's like an appointment with a dietitian. The Palestinians will get a lot thinner, but won't die. Clinton might want to ignore this fact, but Gaza is not a natural disaster. It's an ongoing political conflict. There needs to be a political solution. And all the humanitarian aid in the world isn't going to change this. Gaza will only begin to recover when the siege is lifted and the borders are open. This is what the people of Gaza are saying. And Isham Abu Taha, a wholesaler in the Gaza town of Rafah, said, Gazans don't want handouts. When the borders are open and everyone can work freely, we don't need aid. We don't need aid. And he says the situation will improve dramatically when the world begins to listen. And that, but that's what's going on. So don't think we're rebuilding anything or that anybody's getting anything of any value here.
Well, the border's closed, so they won't get any of the money anyway.
And the Israelis are going to find a way to grab those dollar bills, I'm sure.
It's a big empty gesture, as far as I can see.
It's a joke.
It's an empty gesture.
Sure. If they don't identify Hamas, which is that it was a democratically elected government, then
whether we like it or not,
that's
like some like the rest of the world saying to us, well, we don't really care for Obama, so we'd like to deal with some other.
Yeah, we're not going to deal with him. We're going to deal with Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah, we like him better.
We're going to deal with Rush. Limbaugh instead of Obama.
And we don't like your government, so
yeah,
Rush, get together a few people,
and we'll meet
with him.
We're going to set you up as the interim government to deal with your government. You know what I mean? That's about what it amounts to. And you know, I mean, the whole Israeli-Palestinian issue is an absurdity and an abomination. And got to be corrected. This was the last one here. This puts the icing on the cake here. This really explains what's going on. Israel is to double up West Bank settlers. Israel's housing ministry is reportedly busy making plans to double the number of Zionist settlers in the occupied territories of the West Bank. The Ministry of Construction and Housing is planning to construct at least 73,000 housing units in the West Bank. The anti-settlement group Peace Now disclosed Monday in a report based on the analysis of Israeli government data. The group added, at least 15,000 housing units have already been approved and planned for an additional 58,000 housing units are yet to be approved. Out of the units already approved, nearly 9,000 have been built. Once the plans are carried out, the number of settlers in the territories will be doubled, and the completion of this project will make the plan of creating a Palestinian state next to Israel totally unrealistic. There are currently more than 280,000 Israeli settlers living in some 121 settlements in the West Bank. Another estimated 200,000 live in the East Al-Quds in Jerusalem. Under an internationally drafted roadmap for peace, Israel is committed to dismantle all settlements built since March 2001. Nevertheless, the construction in Israeli settlements jumped 60% in 2008. So who the hell is kidding who here? This is a complete and absolute violation of their own agreements and a complete and utter occupation of an independent state. You know, it's just disgusting. So anyway, Iran asks Interpol to arrest Israeli war criminals. You want to read that?
We read one like this before. Interpol begins studying Iran's request for arrest of 15 senior Israeli officials over war crimes. At a news briefing on Sunday, Tehran's public prosecutor, Saeed Mojazavi, said that Iran had referred the case to the International Criminal Police Organization, drawing on the organization's charter and Israel's violation of the Geneva Conventions. Governments of 180 countries have received the information necessary for identifying the suspects. In Monday's statement, Iran's judiciary said it has asked Interpol to issue an international red notice security alert for the 15 Israeli officials who were involved in the 23-day Israeli offensive on Gaza. The statement added that the judiciary was also looking into complaints made against 100 other Israelis with top military and government posts. In December 2008, Iran's judicial body announced a decision to set up a court to investigate complaints made by wounded Gazans against Israel and delivered to Iran by the Palestinian envoy. The judiciary said that it would be ready to try the implicated Israeli officials in absentia. In the current week, we have completed our investigation of about 15 individuals who are among those criminals. Based on our investigation and according to Article 2 of the Interpol Charter, we asked Interpol to arrest these suspects. Mojazavi said the charges included war crimes, invasion, occupation, genocide, and crimes against humanity. The Iranian prosecutor was referring to Israeli strikes that started on December 27th on the densely populated past Palestinian coastal territories and did not end until it claimed the lives of more than 1,330 Gazans, mostly civilians. Many internationals, NGOs, and human rights organizations, Palestinian wounded in the Gaza onslaught, more than 5,700 Iranian lawyers and attorneys in the Iranian Bar Association, along with a large number of medics, were also among those who filed complaints against Tel Aviv, Mojazavi added. The list of Israeli war criminals includes Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, Defense Minister Ehud Barak, Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni, Chief of the General Staff, Lieutenant Gabi Ashkenazi, Commander-in-Chief of the Israeli Air Force, Ido Nehashtan, Commander of the Gaza War Operation, Major General Yoav Gallant, head of the military intelligence, General Amos Yadlin, commander of Battalion 13 in the Golani Bakrid, Lieutenant Colonel Oren Cohen, deputy to the Gavati Brigade, Colonel Ron Ashrove, commander of the Israel Paratroopers Brigade in the Gaza, Colonel Herzi Halevi, commander of the 401st Armored Corps Brigade, Colonel Yegel Slovit, commander of the 101st Battalion, Paratrooper Brigade, Lieutenant Colonel... excuse me, Avi Blatt. I guess you'll have to read the rest of that. Number 12 and 13.
All right. Commander of the 101st Battalion and the Paratrooper Brigade, Colonel Avi Blatt. Lieutenant Colonel Yov Mordachai, who is commander of the Golani Infantry Brigade, 13th Battalion in Gaza. Javadi Squad Commander Colonel Tomar Tsitsar, and Brigade Commander in Battalion 51, Colonel Avi Peled. So these are the 15 war criminals they're going after.
I don't know if anything will happen, but
who knows?
At least they've tried.
Well, as long as Interpol isn't totally dominated by Mossad, like our White House is. But anyway, let's look at this. This is before we go to our interview.
It's almost
here,
time for
the
interview.
I just wanted to read this quick blurb about former governor of
Illinois
here. Blagojevich.
Blagojevich
gets six-figure book deal.
How about that?
Yeah, this is from CNN.
That's a Phoenix Books.
Yeah.
They're a tell-all, scandal-all books.
Yeah. And anyway. Former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich landed a six-figure book deal to tell his story. His spokesman confirmed it to CNN Monday. Blagojevich was impeached earlier this year amid allegations that he tried to sell President Obama's vacant Senate seat. The former governor, who maintains his innocence, will write about the process and he used to pick Obama's successor, and the dark side of the politics he witnessed in both the state and national level.
That he witnessed?
Yeah.
Didn't
participate in, right? But the former governor will also discuss his two terms in office. This book, which has a working title of The Governor, is scheduled to be released. The working title is called The Governor, is scheduled to be released by Phoenix Books in October. Glenside Blagojevich, publicist and founder of the publicity agency, said the governor will divulge information that will be embarrassing to himself and others. There were some people in high places who didn't want the governor to write this book and worked to try to squash a book deal, Zelig said in a statement released Monday. The Illinois Senate voted unanimously in January to impeach Blagojevich, permanently bar him from holding public office in the state. But there's a fascinating comment that I wanted to read here, and I think this makes a lot of sense. This was by somebody named Lisa Ann, but she stated what Lila and I had figured right before, and we mentioned it on the show that evening when we found out that he had a lot of people against him in business, and the minute that he announced that he was going to suspend business with Bank of America, all right, that's when
the House of Cards fell down.
That next day, boom. Okay, and she mentions this in her comment, and it was a good comment. It says...
Who had said this?
This is a comment that was posted under this by a reader. And it said, you do all know that this wasn't about corruption allegations, right? Mr. Ike posted the story from December 8th that... resulted in Blagojevich's December 9th arrest, namely that Blagojevich took an unprecedented, courageous, though he didn't know how much so, stance in backing the workers of the window and door factory and their sit-in, demanding that they be given their due compensation as union members after the Bank of America refused to give the company a loan, thus closing the factory. In response to December 8th, Blagojevich ordered the state of Illinois to stop conducting any business with Bank of America until Bank of America did the right thing and okayed the loan. Seeing that the governor had just been given, uh, rather, ju- just seeing that the governor had just given Bank of America $5 billion in bailout money, Blagojevich, and BNA should use it as it should be for the people. So why the ongoing investigation, which started much earlier? Madigan wanted his seat in the next race, and he started the investigation. And Blagojevich had gone against the pharmaceutical industry, getting generic drugs for seniors from Canada, and dispelled a hospital CEO on a huge bonus, which was presented as his not caring about kids in a hospital, and probably did plenty of other stuff that doesn't go over well with big business. This guy should be known for the person he is, and his actions have shown he was and still is really for the people. I don't think even he knows that the bogus investigation was stopped short before he could do anything, as the media put it, for the purpose of using their allegations to avert his blocking of business with Bank of America. All right? And I think that's interesting. That tells tales. I mean, that tells the story.
Yeah. I thought that's why he was pulled down, because he was going to
stop doing all business with Bank of America in Chicago. That would have really hurt them. They were forced to keep that factory. That's right. They did get the loan.
Obama stepped in.
Yeah. Well, he didn't really have any chance,
a choice
to do that, especially after they threatened to stop all stuff through that.
Well, it's interesting also that Jesse Jackson's son's problem just
yeah, that just melted away too.
Melted
away. Yeah, really.
Because he was the one that offered to.
Go around and start up a non-profit for him.
Yeah.
All right.
And
he was going to raise $15 million or something like that, if I remember right.
Yeah.
But as it turns out, Burris offered the same thing, but Burris was a little cleaner than it was a little less well known than Jesse Jackson Jr.
Yeah.
And.
Oh, boy.
Well, anyway.
It probably goes back to the bank thing. I think it does, too.
Yeah,
yeah,
really
I thought
does.
That right away.
Yeah, we did, right? We mentioned it on the show, even, Tuesday
well,
night program.
Well, I think
program.
People will get a lot of information from our interview here.
Yeah, and this is Andy Goss, who is going to, who wrote Uncle Sam Cooks the Books, but excellent guest, and really enjoyed talking with him, and I think he will help you understand, as he's helped us understand this bailout, and what the Federal Reserve is all about, and why the hell we are bailing out the Federal Reserve, who is, you know, supposed to be. I mean, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and you'll get the gist of my thrust here in this interview. So I hope it answers a lot of questions for you. So here it is, Andrew Goss.
Louis has been on our show many times before. He's talked to us. He's an economist, and he's talked to us about the Federal Reserve, about banking, about the IRS, about how the money system works, and he's going to help us again tonight to understand what's happening with the economy, why it's happening. Does he see a way for us to wiggle out of the problem that we're in? I mean, it's certainly a worldwide problem. It's not just with the United States economy. It's with everyone. The United States has a central banking system. It's not the only country in the world that has a central banking system, and I think our guest is with us. Good evening, Andrew. Welcome to the L.A. Steel Show.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, good. Well, we've had you on before, and you've helped us understand the banking system of the United States, the Federal Reserve, which until I met you, I thought it was part of the federal government, like many people.
Well, thanks. I've been trying to spread the word for a great many years about the problem.
Well, I tell you, up until this bailout mess, I thought I understood everything with that too. I read your books, and I think I got it. But now that we're, why are we now bailing out
the Federal Reserve Bank? Isn't that what's happening? Is
understand.
That true?
Yeah, I don't understand this.
See, they don't. Contrary to, I guess I oversimplified it by saying that they print money out of thin air.
Okay.
And that concept, you know, that they can create money from nothing really caused people to wonder, well, why would they need a bailout, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But in reality, you know, they do everything. That's why when people call it a conspiracy, I have to disagree, because it's all out in the open.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. That's
generally hidden. The way the Federal Reserve works is it puts a debt instrument on its balance sheet, and then it monetizes that debt instrument. So if you, in other words, if you come to them with an IOU $100, write it on a piece of paper and hand it to them,
right?
And they create $100 and hand it to you. Now the $100 IOU that you just gave them becomes an asset, and the $100 bill that they gave you becomes a liability. So now they have a balance sheet and it balances. They get $100 in assets, $100 in liabilities.
Wow.
That's the simple answer to how the Federal Reserve operates. So now they need so much money,
yeah,
that they can't get debt instruments in there fast enough.
Uh-huh.
They can't get money in there fast enough. So another way that a bank can get money besides borrowing it is to take a deposit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we've done. We've taken $1 trillion out of the United States Treasury.
Right.
And we've said essentially we don't need it.
Yeah, right.
We've deposited it at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And there it sits. As a, you know, a deposit.
And now they're lending us, what, 10 times that amount?
Well, they are, the member banks, the banks that are that own the Federal Reserve, you know, but now
right.
We're talking about J.P. Morgan and Citigroup and
right.
Goldman Sachs. They are allowed to borrow money from the Fed. In addition, they're allowed to loan money to individuals on the basis of the bank's credit.
But in the case of Goldman Sachs, and like Lehman Brothers was in there too.
Sure.
And Morgan Stanley.
Right.
And all these, I mean, these guys are all bankrupt.
Well,
virtually bankrupt. I mean, how can that be?
Well, it's like this. When you start with nothing, I mean, think of starting the Federal Reserve Bank tomorrow. You have nothing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then suddenly somebody comes to you with an IOU on a piece of paper. I owe you $100. Okay, great. I put that in the vault, and now I give you a $100 bill. So now suddenly I have $100 in assets. See? So, I mean, this is essentially what the case is. If you boil these institutions down to what they really are,
right.
They aren't anything.
Uh-huh.
They don't have any worth. All they are is licenses to steal. I mean, that's really the harshest description you can put on them. But a primary bond dealer, which is what these
right.
owners are, has the ability to just buy up U.S. government debt and then pledge it as an asset at 100% of its face value. There's, you know, the ability for fraud is endless.
These are the GSEs that you talk about. They're the government-supported enterprises that I mean, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the Federal Reserve,
right.
And GATA, and countless others that are on that are sponsored by the government.
Right, and they should be part of the government. You mm-hmm. know, the idea that there should be a government institution
right.
grants Americans home mortgages. That should be without saying. The idea that the government, the federal government, through our treasury, would issue our money, that's almost, I mean, you ask any person,
right.
you know, a third grader will tell you that's the way it should be.
Right. Well, they would think, they also think that that's the way it is.
Well, unfortunately,
most people
yeah. right about that.
Yeah.
Any chance that it'll become that way?
I was holding out outside hope. They were talking about nationalizing the banks.
That's what they're talking about, right.
But, you know, the only bank that should be nationalized is the Federal Reserve Bank, because it's the bank of issue.
Right.
That's the one, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York primarily, has the ability to issue money.
Well, I think we now own 40% of Citigroup, don't we?
Indeed we do.
Right, and we own, now the other question is this AIG.
Right.
What in the hell are we doing with AIG? I mean, this is, if there was ever a black hole, financial black hole,
right.
this is it.
One.
You know, this has got to be the mother of all black holes.
Hey, you know, you just made me think of something, though, that you hit a point right on the head. We hit 40% of Citigroup.
Hmm.
Certainly we'll get to AIG. But hey, that does make us, for the first time since 1913, we're part owners of the Federal Reserve Bank.
Yeah.
Good point. So now we should just go ahead and take the rest of it.
Don't you think so? How can we make that happen?
Well, by raising awareness, you know, unfortunately the issue has been sidetracked to one of abolish the Fed, see? So the only thing getting any traction by all the big organizations, you know, from Ron Paul's organization to
right.
you know, Liberty Caucus, you name your so-called Patriot group, and all of them have that same pitch, which is abolish the Fed.
But doesn't
well, if we own it, we don't have to abolish it.
But doesn't that have traction, though? I mean, don't we just abolish the thing and just print our own money?
Well, anytime you get a serious economist, like, you know, if you've got a college close by with an economics guy, you know, professor down there,
Yeah. Fight
him on and talk to him about the Federal Reserve. I mean, if he's knowledgeable, he should be. He'll know that if you abolish the Federal Reserve tomorrow, you know, by next week, there would be tumbleweeds blowing through the streets of America's cities. There would be no...
Oh, wait, no. As far as I can remember, John F. Kennedy, wanted to do that. Of course, they shot him for it, but he wanted to do it.
Well,
and not only that, but he issued, what, $4 trillion worth of treasury money, our own, you know, money, non-debt money.
Well, it would be the equivalent of $4 trillion today. You know, it was
yeah.
a chunk of money then. And he authorized the printing of silver certificates
right.
against what silver was in the treasury. So, yeah, he was taking steps against the Federal Reserve, no doubt about it. And one of the last presidents to do so. See, and this is the thing. If every president since then has been more or less, you know, let the Fed do what they want,
right.
I don't see that there's any change with the current one.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, you have, in your book, Uncle Sam Cooks the Books, You had mentioned that the best way, I mean, the worst thing that can happen, was you said, was for people to stop spending money or conserve, not to spend money.
Right.
All right. The best thing that could happen is to create more money. All right. Because more people, more credit, more money, more spending, bigger economy, and that's the way that this economy works.
Right. And the only president that's ever really come out and explained it to us was. George Bush Sr. Tried to explain when they asked him, well, how do you see us paying off a $5 trillion debt with only $3 trillion in money?
Yeah.
And he just kind of like put his arms apart. He said, well, you have to grow the money. You have to grow it. You have to grow the money.
You got to grow the money.
Exactly. And people stood him to be an idiot. You know, oh, he's just simplifying. Of course you got to grow the money. Well, he literally meant it. And, from his day to this, we've seen five times quintupling.
Well, I think his son kind of learned might have learned that lesson. Okay, when he put us into a $1 trillion deficit, I mean, is that growing the money?
Well, it is, because you see, each time the Treasury issues a debt, like I owe you $1 trillion,
right.
Then the Federal Reserve Bank of New York gets to create $1 trillion and loan it to the Congress. So that's about as good as you can get right there.
Well, yeah, I was so thrilled to see that they were only charging us for our money. They were only charging, less than a 1% now, isn't it? 1%?
Well,
I mean,
you know, any percent is free money because, let's face it, there's nothing there.
There's nothing there, yeah.
So what's going to happen to all of us? We seem to be hanging off a precipice here.
Well, I think the choice was made pretty simple. You know, it's either we're going to put the pedal to the metal and go flying over the cliff, or we're going to slam on the brakes and go screeching.
You know? Over the cliff. You think we're going to go over the cliff regardless?
Well, pretty much. I think if you look at the history of every fiat currency ever.
I think this is like a Thelma and Louise economy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Don't they drive their car right off over the cliff, you know?
They do,
yeah.
And they do it with that same flourish.
and
look at what the federal government's response is, which is instead of allowing these insolvent institutions to fail and letting the debt work itself out,
yeah.
Essentially what you had was $45 trillion in debt and $15 trillion in money.
Mm.
So what would have been a logical one is, okay, we let AIG go bankrupt, we let Lehman Brothers go bankrupt, and then we settle up at 30 cents on the dollar. But the problem there would have been that, you know, everyone's house would have fallen by two-thirds, and so then the banks would have been even further upside down because, let's face it, I give them the keys.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, absolutely.
As would the rest of America. So there's that old adage that says, you know, when you owe $250,000, you're in trouble. When the point, you know, how's that go? You owe the bank $250,000, they're in trouble. Yeah, right. Something. If you owe the bank $200, you're in trouble. If you owe the bank $250,000, they're in trouble. And that's what would happen for those who paid off their mortgages. And I was one of the guys that was saying, no, don't pay off your mortgage. Not only don't pay off your mortgage, but keep the biggest mortgage that you can on your property. Because the irony is here that everyone who paid off their mortgage Well, the house can go down to $10. They won't get any help at all. But those who didn't pay, have a hefty mortgage, are now being in a position, oh, well, we'll forgive a portion of the mortgage.
And we'll drop your rate.
And or we'll drop your rate, or we'll, you know, we'll do whatever, we'll renegotiate.
Yeah.
And so this is really the crux of what happens in that deflationary environment. Everyone gets to renegotiate their debts, and debts are settled for 30 cents on the dollar, and property foreclosures, not just houses, but cars and, you know, everything else.
Right.
Is so great that it just keeps pushing down the value of every tangible thing until it finally settles out and there's enough money again, just enough money to represent the property in circulation. But it is so painful.
But what I hear all the talking heads talking about is that, you know, the economists and so on, is saying that the market, that by bailing out the marketplace like we're doing, it's not allowing it to... it's not allowing it to establish a floor.
That's right.
You know, so you know, by doing that, you know, if we had, for instance, I guess there were, if we hadn't bailed out some of these banks, investors would have just bought it, you know, come in and bought it at the lowest possible rate, and,
right.
You know, and we would have had something to begin with.
Well, that's the point. That would have been somewhere around 30 cents.
Yeah, right.
That's the point, you know, that
yeah.
All of these assets would have...
Well, what was Lehman? They were about 40 cents. Okay, weren't they?
We're going to continue this. I just have to turn over the tape. Here we go.
We couldn't have continued as an economy.
No, that's true.
And then, so the choice was either, okay, you don't do anything, and then... That's the crash that everybody talks about, because there's not enough money to pay all the debt.
I mean, the Republican idea is do nothing. We shouldn't do anything. And they, you know, do nothing. Let it all fall.
Yeah, well, I don't know that that's Republican as much as that is laissez-faire.
Laissez-faire,
that is hands-off.
Yeah, right.
There's no role in government for that.
No.
But I disagree. I think that...
you got to do something. I mean, something's got to happen.
What do you think of what Obama's plan is and how this is going
on? Do you think the stimulus plan makes any sense?
Well, it's the wrong way to stimulate. You know, if you're going to really stimulate an economy, you have to actually put in something that is productive. You know, there has to be...
Well, you know what amazed me?
Well, exactly.
What amazed me was I saw this... Did you see the speech today at the transportation?
No, I didn't.
Oh, my God.
But I heard the comments about the stock market, for example, right? Is that the one?
No, this is the one he gave at the DOT.
Okay.
And he was talking about the big stimulus plan to rebuild the infrastructure and all this kind of crap. And, you know, he says, I've got a plan that's going to make 400,000 jobs. But he says, and part of those jobs are jobs that are already in existence, but it'll keep those jobs. Right? And I went... 400,000 jobs. We're hemorrhaging 400,000 jobs a week right now. I said, what the hell is this? And then he says, oh, we're going to have the biggest infrastructure, blah, 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 blah. And he's got Joe Biden is going to make sure that he's the sheriff, he said.
Right.
And he's going to make sure our money is well spent.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I'm looking at this and I'm going, okay, now this guy's got $800 billion. All right? And he's got this big infrastructure program. And all it's going to produce is 400,000 jobs?
A bit of a disappointment.
Right? When we've already lost, 3.5 million jobs since the beginning of the year? I mean, you know, this is insane.
So what were your thoughts on what should be done?
Does this make any sense to you?
Well, I mean, if you're not creating permanent jobs...
Mm-hmm. You say this is permanent jobs.
Yeah, when you're just building something that now is going to do what? You know, the build a bridge idea, build a bridge and they will come.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Being traffic is not productive enough.
Well, you know what, Frank?
And more productive if he would have said, for example, nothing focuses the corporate mind like an order, right?
Right.
So if he's willing to spend that kind of money, $800 billion, if he would have just said to GM, here's $1 billion, I want Chevy Volts, you know, those electric Chevy cars.
Right, that's all I want.
They run for 2 cents a mile on electricity that's generated here in the United States, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone who has an old American car, anyone who files a tax return or anyone who's an American citizen, okay, bring your old car and exchange it heads up for one of these Chevy Volts.
Ah.
Okay, so now that taking that old car off the road subtracts 14 cents from the GDP, from the trade deficit, because that's 14 cents per mile that we don't have to bring oil or gas in.
Uh-huh.
And we replace it with a car that gets 2 cents per mile of domestic produced energy, so that adds to the domestic product, right?
Has anybody thought about this?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm positive, because when you look at all of their projects, perfect example would be Hoover Dam, right?
Right.
Right.
That's a good example of, okay, you spend the money, but you produce something that is now self-sufficient.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And revenue generating.
That's true.
You know, that thing has paid for itself so many times. It's unfunny.
Yeah.
And if we did those types of things, like, okay, we're going to go out in Southern California, we're going to build a gigantic solar manufacturing facility, and then as soon as the solar panels come off, we'll put them on a truck and we'll send them out to the middle of the desert where there's no one.
Right.
We'll set them up and run the cable back on the way back.
Yeah.
That, it would be a permanent installation that returns. Pays for itself. The cars, that would be the definite pays for itself type of a deal. And there's not enough of those. There's too many of the, oh, well, the road could be wider, so we'll just pay people to make it.
Yeah, but you know, the craziest thing is this. All right, now I was looking at, I was sitting back there, and I'm a middle-aged guy. Now, if I was a middle-aged guy who just lost my job, and looking forward to, you know, and a white collar worker, right, or in the banking industry, or in the insurance industry, or even in the auto industry, he's talking about, these are good solid jobs. These are jobs where you're building highways and fixing potholes and I mean, guys, you know what I mean? I mean, it's like, yeah, that's a great job for a guy in his 20s and 30s,
right.
But it's a lousy job for a guy in his 50s and 60s and 70s, you know what I mean, who needs a job.
We need productivity and
you know,
productive jobs.
Can you see a 70-year-old guy out there swinging a pickaxe? You know, I don't think so.
The fact that he has to is what really is
the fact that he has
to. That's the sad part.
Because his 401k just, went to...
K. Yeah. It doesn't even have a K on it anymore.
It doesn't even have a K on it, right.
Well, you know, if in fact we change the way that we issue money, we could eliminate the interest on the income tax.
Right.
The interest on the national debt. If we eliminate the interest on the national debt, then that money that, I mean, even if we keep gathering the income tax, which I would argue that we wouldn't have to after that, we could then spend it more on retirement and social programs. You know, after somebody works all their life,
care
what they did. When they're 70, you know, they shouldn't have to be out there looking for another job just to make ends meet.
No, I agree, and especially, fixing a road.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or building a bridge.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's like, come on.
Yeah.
You know, but this is what he's offering. He's only offering enough that 400,000 jobs. He's only, I mean, a lot of those jobs are already existing, and people are working in them. You know, we're keeping these jobs, you know.
Now, we have a number of states that are also going bankrupt that have problems. And one of the solutions to that I've read about is that actually states can create their own banks, and North Dakota did.
That's right. You know, the North Bank of North Dakota is a prime example of what every state in the country should do. In my own state of New Jersey, it's ludicrous that we take $70 billion in the state's money and we deposit it with J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs and others.
Yeah.
And then every time we want to build something on a local level, a school or a road, we have to bond and then borrow the money from the same guys and pay them a 5% or 6% spread.
Yeah.
If the money stayed in the treasury or a state-owned bank,
mm-hmm.
then the revenue and the profit would go towards making the job better or making it cheaper.
Right.
And that really is a big difference. If every state had its own state-owned bank, and then additionally the Federal Reserve Bank were owned by the federal government, then we as individuals would not have to pay such a deafening tax burden.
So how would you go about getting your state to found its own state-owned bank?
Well, first you have to find a politician that's not corrupt. And that, when you get done with that,
that's
let
a challenge.
Call, and I'll certainly help you out.
That's
if you look at the contributions on both sides of the aisle, you'll find all these same names. You know, the number one contributor, Goldman Sachs, by far. And that industry, you know, the investment banking and banking industry, number one contributor, both political parties, the two major ones, forgive me, any other political party that comes of any significance, finally finds itself quickly getting contributions from those very same people.
Well, how did North Dakota go about getting their own bank?
In the midst of the founding of the Federal Reserve Bank in 1913, you know, the very things that they were accused of doing, which is cutting off off credit to areas that they want to take over.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the farmland in that part of the country was one of the areas they had their eyes on.
Oh.
So they essentially cut credit to those farmers. So, you know, being the electorate, they put in a populist. this is at a time when information about money was still widely available.
Mm.
The Federal Reserve Bank was new in its existence, so everyone knew what a bank was all about. And so it was put through the legislature, passed in 1919.
Oh, wow.
It's almost as old as the Federal Reserve Bank. And it weathered through the Depression in the 30s, like flying colors. North Dakota, look at the way they got through it, much better than the rest of the country.
Hmm.
We would be much better off with state-owned state banks and a federally owned federal bank.
Hmm.
One a mortgage bank and the other a commercial bank.
Hmm. So what you have to do is find yourself an honest politician.
Right. And then get him to sponsor a bill authorizing a state-owned bank and watch the forces that, you know, come rising. You'll be able to... You'll know who the opposition is then. I'll tell you what. You'll know which politicians are paid for and which aren't.
All right.
That would be an interesting process, huh?
I could see Dodd,
Senator.
He would be babbling again.
He'd have a heart attack.
How about you? I can only imagine, yeah.
Can you see it? I mean, he would just have a heart attack.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it would be so adamantly opposed. And so if there's anything that you want to do or any citizens out there want to do towards that end, please give me a call. I would do everything in my power to help.
Well, that's something we might start right here.
Yeah, take a campaign on. Listen, people do things that really make a difference at times, and this could be one of them because...
This makes a whole lot of sense.
They're screaming my head off, and I don't know who's paying attention. Maybe they're just very successful at ignoring me.
So many states are in trouble, and it would just make so much sense for them to do that. California is
a perfect example. I can't think of a better example.
Mm-hmm.
If you call the state treasurer of California or go to the state treasurer's website,
right,
download the consolidated or comprehensive annual financial report, and look at the various trust funds and funds that are kept in institutions, find what they call institutional balances throughout the state, I bet you'll find at least as many as I found in New Jersey, which is like $70 billion.
Wow.
And this is all money that you'll find is on deposit with these same institutions that are at the source of the news today.
So actually what can happen is that they can take their deposits and put them in their own...
In your own state-owned bank.
Right.
In the treasury or state-owned bank.
And they could bond themselves right out of the current crisis.
Right.
Because, you know, if you say to those banks essentially, okay, listen, we're calling in our deposits. Same thing Andrew Jackson did. Okay, so give us all the deposits now. We put them in the state-owned bank,
mm-hmm.
Bank of California, and then we write the state a loan immediately, or whatever it's going to take to fill the budget shortfall.
Right.
And it's done.
And it's done, exactly.
And they have
every other municipality in the state, if you have a current project that you're going to pay from with municipal tax dollars,
right,
bring it to the bank. And do not bond it through any of the bonding entities. Bring it right to the bank. Okay, what are you building? A school? Great. Here's your money.
Right.
Now 2%, 3%, which is about the same return that we're getting.
But all that money goes right back to the state.
Indeed it does.
That's
which
right.
is beautiful.
Stays
you know?
Right in your state.
Yeah.
And that's the type of banking established reform that needs to go on. Because to keep doing it the same stupid way, it's not going to get any better.
It's to keep everybody impoverished.
Well, you know what? It has been identified as the single best form of slavery there is. I did a story on the Charleston slave badges for one of my newsletters maybe 10 years ago, and I highlighted the way that the system of property was maintained on the southern plantations. The skilled slaves were given little badges, and they could go out in the economy and earn their wage. And whatever they were whatever they were good at, if they were coopers or blacksmiths, say high wages, then they brought those wages back to the plantation house and gave it to the master, and he would decide what portion of it they got to keep. And that is a system of chattel slavery. That is essentially the system that we're under now. Another good example would be the company store system in the West Virginia and Kentucky coal mines.
That's right, yeah.
Where you're issued store, you're paid with company scrip, you know, Federal Reserve notes, and then you have to spend them at the store that's also owned by the same people that issue the notes.
Mm-hmm.
The prices are closely regulated to what you make.
Right.
Yep.
That is exactly the perfect system of slavery, a combination of those two.
So at this point now, okay, we have to, right now they're talking about $800 billion a good portion of that, probably half of that or more, is going to bail out the banks again.
Peanuts.
Yeah. What's that?
Peanuts. Yeah.
So now, and they're talking about a possibility of another one or two more stimulus packages.
Oh, of course, yeah, including a direct one to individuals and a 4% 40-year mortgage.
Right.
So now all of this, it reminds me, you remember those old Dorito commercials?
Yep.
What was the punchline? You remember what it was?
Oh, God, what is
it? It was crunch all.
I don't remember.
Crunch what?
Crunch all you want.
Yeah.
We'll make more.
Oh, yes, okay. Yes, that's right. I remember that.
Right. Crunch all you want. We'll make more. It was a great commercial.
Yeah, but the one I was thinking about was the Dorito Bandito.
Yeah, that's the one.
No,
but this one is really the theme song of the Federal Reserve.
Crunch more. We'll make.
Crunch all you want. We'll make more and loan it to you.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you know we have a $1.75 trillion deficit in the current budget.
Mm-hmm.
So at $1.75 trillion, that's nearly $2 trillion. You know, it's like, thank God it's not in the hundreds of billions anymore. You know, $900 billion, that sounds like so much. Wow, 1.75, that's tiny. It's just 1.75.
Yeah.
We are in a stratosphere as it relates to money. So, you know.
Oh, we are. There's just absolutely.
$400 billion, look for the new word. You know what it is? Quadrillion.
You know, I had to laugh. I really had to laugh when your book. I want people to really go and get this book. Uncle Sam Cooks the Books. That's
if you can find that one. That's a tough one from 2003. Then.
Oh, we love that.
It's a great book. It really is.
It explains
what
so much
you,
to
what
me.
Have you got out now, Andrew?
I'm working on one right now. You know, you touched on the topic. The presidents, four presidents who have tried to modify the monetary system and what happened to them.
Right.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
And because the link is compelling.
Mm-hmm. No, it is. I mean,
right?
Well,
it's
Abe Lincoln. Actually,
was
Andrew
it John
Jackson.
Kennedy.
No, yeah, we got to start with Lincoln because Jackson was successful.
Right.
they tried to kill him.
But Lincoln,
he did, yeah, so many times. He died with lead in his body. For
yeah.
Sure. But it was Lincoln.
Lincoln. Okay.
Garfield.
Oh, okay.
Lee and Kennedy.
Okay. So and they were all assassinated within, you know, first terms. When they started to do it.
When they started messing with the money. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right. But you know what I read?
It makes one kind of nervous to think about that then, huh?
Well, it just goes to show, I think it was Madison that said that these guys will employ every means. You know, there's nothing that they won't stoop to. The depredations, I think.
Yeah, of what they will do.
They'll do anything to save that power.
Yeah. Mm. That's what we're frightened of. But what would happen? I'm seriously, seriously wanting to take you up on this offer because if we could do something in advocating a state bank in Connecticut, maybe you could tell me how I go about getting that kind of.
Well,
I mean, we have a voice here, and we have the. The audience, but we're celebrating our 6-year anniversary, by the way.
Congratulations. Well, the first thing you have to do is make it make sense, right?
Uh-huh. Exactly.
And so, to that end, you want to get a hold of the Consolidated Annual Financial Report.
Okay.
That's the number one thing. And get for the last 3 years. And then, as soon as you have that, contact me, and I'll tell you how to read it.
Once
you identify where the money is, then you can ask who's it on deposit with, who's got it right now.
Okay.
And you'll
then you'll know where
it is. That it's those same institutions that are at the head of this bailout crowd.
So what's the name of this thing that we have to get?
Consolidated Annual Financial
Report.
Okay. And that first one is either consolidated or comprehensive, depending on which state you're in.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
All right.
But once you get that from the treasurer, then you can find the line items that support the balances that are in all of the various constituent units of the state.
Okay.
So, you know, you have what state is it? Connecticut.
Connecticut, yeah.
You have the Connecticut Turnpike Authority, right?
I don't know whether we have that.
Well, you've got to have all of these constituent units, these authority units.
It's under DOT, I'm sure.
And you'll find them in the consolidated report.
Okay.
And every one of them, at the when they build things into their budget each year, so we're going to need $100 a year to replace bridges, and we're going to save that $100 a year until we get to $1 million, and then we'll do something.
Right.
Each year they put that $100 in a separate account, and so it's accounted for, but it's just still sitting there.
Oh, I see.
And until they get their sinking fund sunk, you know, that's how they operate, then they don't, the money's spent as far as the taxpayer is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we'll find it. We'll consolidated or comprehensive annual financial report, and then once I put my fingers on the money, then you'll be able to say, well, this is what we have, and this is the legislation now we propose a state bank, and then you get yourself an assemblyman or senator, somebody to
have that bill.
And, you know, away you go. And it would be a wonderful thing. It would really lead the way, and it's timely, but my plate is so full, I'm in emergency mode right now.
Yeah.
Because I feel like if Americans don't have what is money, then they don't have anything. And so I'm trying to shake out all the addicts to get the gold and silver coins, you know, the old silver dollars, the $20 gold pieces, the quarters, dimes, the halves, the half dimes, all those old coins that were minted by the Treasury when there was money.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the situation is so severe that ultimately that is the only real money in this country. Everything else is paper or a representation of money.
Mm.
And that is the only real money. And so that's what I'm doing. If you have any of that stuff, you want to sell it to me, I have plenty of Federal Reserve notes I'll pile on your door. You just give me a call.
Well, I'm going to tell you, let's put out your name and your website here right now.
Oh, yeah, it's easy. It's usgoldcoins.com if you want to buy or sell American gold and silver coins. If you want to learn more about what we've been talking about the rest of the evening, Andy Gause, G-A-U-S-E, is my name, and my website is andygause.com, G-A-U-S-E, Andy, first name, .com. Go there. Educate yourself. Learn.
It's a great site. You offer a newsletter.
Sure. And the back issues of the newsletter all the way to 96. You could get a good education just reading the back issues.
I was looking at your site, I think yesterday, and you weren't offering your books on there. You had them on tape.
I'm going to have to reprint those things because it's it's the Wild West out there. You mentioned, what was it? Uncle Sam Cooks the Book.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You go to Amazon.com. I mean, people are selling those things for $80 to $100. So
are you serious, really? Oh,
I'm pretty sure.
Oh,
I haven't been there in a while, but I've heard people really begging for them. And so I'm going to do a reprint of that one as soon as I finish.
Oh, you really should. That's a wonderful book,
I
think. So clearly, so easy to understand. Well, for me, it was a real eye-opener and really explained things to me that I really didn't understand at all.
Well, I'm not really a writer. That's not my thing. You know, it's just trying to explain these subjects to people so that they can grasp it. That's my thing.
You did a great job.
And you did. You made it.
I'll tell you, I just didn't understand.
Until I read your book.
No, using your book. I was going through this the last couple of weeks, and I'm saying, I don't understand why we are bailing out the Federal Reserve.
Right.
It made no sense.
Yeah, I'm looking at Amazon now. It's the new ones are $37.95, and the collectible ones are $84.95.
Oh, my.
But I'm going to try to get that back into print as soon as I can, because people should read it. It's a decent little book. It's not.
And The Secret World of Money as well.
Well, that one's been in publication since 1996.
Right.
I think the last reprint I did on that one was maybe 3 years ago. I think that's available used for like $18 or $20, and new probably in the same $20 to $30 range. But we do have a special at the website. I think it's $25. You get both books. So if anybody's really interested in those, you're better off though to seek out your local bookseller.
Plus, you got some other stuff too. You got some DVDs. I think of your. I don't know, lectures or talks or whatever.
Yeah, people have clipped those and put them up on YouTube and things like that. I saw an old one from Tony Brown.
Oh, wow.
Floating around the web. That was back in the early 90s. Mm. There's material out there. There's a lot of people saying it now, though, so this is what I like, the fact that I'm not the only guy talking about it.
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
I'd like to talk to you another time soon about maybe the connection between the Royal Bank of Scotland and the British.
Oh, sure. That's an easy one. The Bank of England connection there is old. And certainly RBS fits right into that picture.
Yeah.
I think what's more shocking to people is that we really never lost our connection to the British.
No. And
the Bank of England has controlled our monetary system for quite a long time.
Yeah. And you know what else stunned me was the fact that George III actually funded our revolution.
Well, that's right. Both sides, thanks to the Rothschilds.
Yeah.
You know, they know the trick there, and that is that if you control both sides of a
war, you're going to make money. Yeah,
that's true. And in fact, if you look at their practices during our own war here in the United States, you'll see that they were financing both the North and the South.
They were financing both, exactly. Yeah, we were duped in both ways, I'll tell you.
And no question.
And it still goes on all over the world.
Yes.
I mean, it hasn't stopped, and that's a very sad thing.
And you find their hands in the till.
Yep.
Everywhere you go. But, Andrew, our show's up, but I want to thank you so much for being with us tonight. And I'm taking you up on that, on your offer. I think and the people of Connecticut out there who are listening, have heard you say it. So we hope to have you back on very soon with some advice on how to put this bank together.
Well, thank you so much. I hope that works out, and I'll definitely be able to help you there.
Well, we're going to try. I'm making a commitment to at least,
look into it anyway.
Looking into what was it again?
Comprehensive Annual Financial Report.
That's it, yeah.
All right, and we'll get that, and I'll try to PDF it down to you somehow.
Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you, Andrew.
Thank you so much.
That was Andrew Goss talking to us about the Federal Reserve, the state of the economy, and state banks.
Yeah, that's great.
And how they may be the answer to...
I'm still a little confused, but I think I understand it now, why we're bailing out these banks. But I don't understand why we have to pay them to do that.
I'm a little confused by all
that. Why do we have to pay interest to these banks to lend them the money to bail them out? It makes absolutely still no sense to me. But that's the Federal Reserve. It makes no sense. You're not supposed to understand it.
Just
pay for it through the nose. But
okay,
we're not going to do that anymore, because from now on, right here on our 6th anniversary show, we are going to begin the work to start the State of Connecticut Bank.
I also want to remind you to people who have supported us.
Wait a minute. Any politicians out there who might be listening, or any advocates or activists who are out there who might be listening to the show and might have heard Andrew say that we can establish a state bank and we can, can stop the hemorrhaging of money and fund every project in this
state. Like the state of North Dakota, which is doing very well.
Right, and survive this nightmare, then let us know. You can contact me at lasteeltv@yahoo.com if you're interested in helping me out. But I do say we're going to have this. I'm going to be working with Andy, and I hope to have him on regularly as he to understand this banking process. So we are going to do that. Anyway, thank you, everybody, for joining us. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you learned something, and like you do every week here. And
thanks for choosing the LA Steel Show.
Choose
us again next Tuesday night from 8 to 10, where we'll have an exciting guest and interesting conversation.
I think we'll have Keith Armand Snow on next week.
Oh, good.
I'm sure, but we're going to try. And again, John Brennan. And again, I want to thank everybody who helped us out for the last 6 years, and Reverend Dennis and a great Joe Lavero. If you're out there listening, Joe, love you still. And I want to thank Judy, manager here, and everybody who has kept us on
in
the
support
air.
Of and asked me our union for
and asked me for sure
keeping us
and
on.
And all the old Blue News was our sponsor who put us out here. But I want to thank everybody, and have a pleasant evening, and join us at lasteelshow.org Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday night at 8 o'clock, and
happy
sing out with us.
To you.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Andrew Goss, and you can go to his website, Andy Goss, G-A-U-S-E, .com, and a whole lot of information there. Fascinating guy. So thank you, and have a pleasant evening. Good night. Oh, join us tomorrow night, Thursday night. We'll be discussing the Flower of Life series by John Velo Melchizedek, and I'll be reading a little more on that, and Friday night with George Dixon. So talk to you later. Thanks for joining us, and good night.